Writing as confession.
If you say to somebody, how are you? And they say, how am I? My life's miserable. I don't love my husband. My kids are horrible monsters. And I stole $400 last week. Admit it. That's what you want to hear.
It's the Woodstock Writers Festival and the memoir boom. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. We're living in what's been called the age of memoir. The public has a hunger for real stories, whether they're on television, on the radio, consider the huge popularity of the Moth Radio Hour, or in literature. Thanks to computers, more of us are writing than ever before. We blog, we write stories, poetry, and even song lyric. And events like the Woodstock Writers Festival, coming up from April 3rd to 6th in the legendary arts town of Woodstock, New York, cater not only to writers, but to people who love to read. Martha Frankel, one of the founders of the event, is the author of Hats and Eyeglasses and Brazilian Sexy.
Well, I started the festival with a lot of other people who slowly fell by the wayside, and I was the last one standing. That's really the way I look at it sometimes. And I think everybody else said, oh my God, I have a real life. But I felt, wow, this could be a good, you know, third of my life. That would be great. And so I think that's why I'm in charge.
Do you get overwhelmed? Because I think there are a lot of people who have wonderful ideas and things they want to do, but then they see the complexity of what it is they're trying to do and they just get totally overwhelmed and it stops them dead.
I think that I don't get overwhelmed, not because I know something that other people don't, but because I don't think about it. I just sort of go forward and think, okay, today I have to do that. I'm a great list maker. And very often at the end of the day, I feel like I've done so much, and I look at my list, and absolutely nothing has gotten crossed off. And somehow, instead of pulling into my shell and wanting to kill myself, it makes me happy. I'm like, wow, I got a lot done today, and I didn't even have to bother with that silly little list.
Martha, it's called the Woodstock Writers Festival, but you've told me you actually wish you could give it a different name.
If I had to do it over again, I would name it the Woodstock Readers Festival, because that's what it is. It's a festival for readers. That's like assuming that the Luthiers Festival is only for guitar makers. It's not. It's for people who love guitar playing, or that the film festival is only for filmmakers instead of people who love film. I want people to understand that you can come to one of these panels and just have your mind blown by somebody whose work you know or somebody whose work you don't. And I think that's the real fun, is to go to a panel and, you know, you like one person, you never heard of the other three, and then you have to have their books because they were just so fantastic.
Well, it truly is a new festival every year, but you've got quite a few new things going on this year.
We have a new look, which I love, and a new website, which is wonderful and really easy to navigate. But on Saturday night, our keynote speaker is really different for us. It's Stephen Tobolowsky. He is the most hardworking character actor in the world. And everybody says, oh, I don't know who that is, until they see his picture, and then they scream because he's played such incredible characters, including Needle Nose Ned in Groundhog Day. And if you've ever seen that movie, he's the guy who keeps coming up to him every day and saying, Phil, he's coming, and he has a new book out, and he's doing like a performance. You know, Saturday and Sunday we do the panels all day. You get to hear writers talking about their books and what the books mean and how they figured out the ideas for them. And James Howard Kunstler is coming to do a talk. He talks about the future, and a lot of it is based on where we're going to be with energy. And we're doing fiction and biography and journalism and memoir. We're also doing something called yoga, writing, and music, which is going to be really fun. We're doing a breakfast with Gail Straub and Carol Zaloom. Gail just wrote an adult fairy tale, and Carol did the woodcuts, and both of them, the words and the pictures together, are amazing. And so they're going to do a breakfast with the editor, Nan Satter, and they're just going to talk about that collaborative effort.
Martha, you mentioned the memoir workshops. I was curious, just what is the appeal of memoir these days?
Well, I think it started with Frank McCourt and Angela's Ashes, which was such an intimate book. And, you know, I'm sure that when Frank was writing it, he wondered how his family was going to take it and who was going to stop talking to him. But, of course, it's the opposite. He wrote it, and even though his mother, his family comes off, you know, as conflicted, people fell in love with her, with Angela. And I think, you know, that sort of started the craze. And we're so lucky. We have great memoir writers who live in town. Abigail Thomas teaches a memoir class, and that's always really, really fun. And we do a memoir panel with this year with, this is the panel that I lead just because I'm the boss and I get to do that. Sean Strube, who wrote a great book about the AIDS epidemic called Body Counts, and a young writer named Dominika Ruda, who wrote a wonderful book about her mother, M.K. Asante, who wrote Buck. This is just totally fabulous. Beverly D'Onofrio, who just moved to town, who wrote the seminal memoir, Writing in Cars with Boys. And so we're just going to be sitting around and talking about what it's like to divulge, you know, your secrets in public. And I think that that's what it is that we live in a very confessional time. It's no wonder that memoir and reality TV are both popular at the same time. Because even though one is an elevated form, it's an elevated form of the other. And so I love memoir. I read a lot of them. And I'm just really excited. This panel is a little bit different than the ones we normally have. And you never know what's going to happen. You really never know what's going to happen in any of these panels because emotions happen. People say things that, you know, really get to other people. It's fascinating.
Have you ever considered the connection between soap operas and the memoir? We love our drama, but now we want it to be true.
Well, it's very funny. My husband, Steve Heller, his mother lived in Woodstock, and she was ill for a while, and they had trouble getting blood from her. We went to the hospital one day, and a woman I knew was the phlebotomist, and she said to my mother-in-law, she said, "Listen, stop crying. This is going to be fine, but first we have to watch General Hospital." And the three of us, you know, were watching it, and I said to her at one point, I said, "Who's that?" And she said, "Oh, that woman? She's the head of the World Police." And for the 3 years that my mother-in-law had left, we watched that soap opera every day. And when I was traveling, which I did a lot in those days, I would call her to find out what was going on. And one of the greatest experiences of my life was waking up on a plane, and the head of the World Police was sitting next to me. It was so exciting. I started crying. Anyway, but I had never watched soap opera before. I didn't understand the pull because it seemed so phony to me. You know, people get amnesia. Who gets amnesia in the real world? But it's you're absolutely right. There is this connection between that. People want to know if you say to somebody, "How are you?" And they say, "How am I? My life's miserable. I don't love my husband. My kids are horrible monsters. And I stole $400 last week." Admit it. That's what you want to hear. But that doesn't happen too often.
It's a lot more interesting than fine.
Yeah, fine. And you? But we don't get it. But in memoir, we do. We get people, the best memoirists are telling us the most horrible things about themselves. And yet, they've built up a platform of people, you know, of this person that we are there with them for some reason. You know what I mean? Whatever it was that made them a great character. Then when they do the bad thing, we don't care. We are there. We're supportive of them. So I think memoir, it's just a perfect time for a perfect kind of reading for our age, for our times.
Martha, for the writer, does it take the place of therapy?
I don't know. I teach writing, and I tell my students all the time, just because I sit in a chair and you sit on a couch and we cry and you tell me your secrets doesn't mean this is therapy. So I've written a memoir. I will say it was the opposite of therapy. It was the scariest thing I ever did. I literally was seeing spots in front of my eyes. I was so scared when I was writing it. And I think for most writers, that's the truth, is that it's terrifying. I truthfully haven't been in therapy a lot, so I don't know. Is therapy terrifying?
The consensus that I hear is yes. It's awful. You're in a worse mood than you were when you walked in, but it's an opportunity to really scratch the surface and see the truth.
If that's what therapy is, then yes, I'll say yes.
Martha Frankel is the director of the Woodstock Writers Festival. Find out more and get tickets online at woodstockwriters.com. Coming up, examining policy from a women's perspective and remembering the woman who woke up the world. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1289. Congressman Bill Owens of New York will leave the House at the end of the year. However, before he leaves, he'll be looking for women's input on a range of legislative issues. Owens told 51%'s executive producer Alan Shartok about the Women's Advisory Committee he established at the end of 2013. About 80 women from communities across New York's 16,000-square-mile 21st Congressional District have been asked to be part of the panel.
Bill Owens, I wanted to talk to you about your new Women's Advisory Committee. And I'm wondering why you did it, why you appointed such a group, and what you hope to get out of it.
What we are looking to do is, as we've done with the Farm Advisory Group, is to look at issues that are, if you will, defined, at least by the media, as women's issues, but also to make sure that we're getting input from women on the issue that really, if you will, drives almost everybody in my district, and of course that is the economic and jobs questions. We have many more women today who are CEOs running their own businesses. And we need to take advantage of that experience and to make sure that we're getting that kind of input on a regular basis. And so what we'll do is we will, on a regular basis, reach out, if you will. Sometimes it'll just be an email with an update saying, here's where something is we think may be of interest to you. And I'll tell you that I do this with a lot of people on a lot of issues. I'm frequently sending articles to people in the district about a wide variety of subjects and asking what their opinion is as I read something in the national press or sometimes in the local press. I think it's very important to get that continuous flow of information and to develop that dialogue.
You know, you just mentioned something that was interesting to me. 17%, I just heard on NPR, 17% of the CEOs of major corporations are women. How come so low, do you think?
Well, I think that that goes back a little bit to some of the conversations we've recently had about the role of women in society. I think it's an evolving issue, probably started during World War II, as women went into the workforce, as men went off to war. It continued really through the last century and I think is evolving further today. And I think that it's an important part of our overall evolution, and it recognizes people for their ability, not their gender.
But so many women are now running for public office more than ever. You have a lot of colleagues who are women. Do you think it makes a difference whether or not women are in the House?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because from my perspective, it is not whether someone is a man or a woman. It is what they bring to the table. So I think the important thing is that in people's minds, when they make a judgment, they don't make a judgment, is this person a woman? And the same thing really goes for race questions. It's not a function. We should literally be, as the old symbol of justice, with justice being blind, our relationship should be blind in that sense as well. So we're making decisions based upon the quality of the idea and the quality of the person performing the work.
So we see things like women's caucuses in the House, and does that further what you've just been talking about? In other words, that we value people as individuals, or Are there political reasons, sociological reasons, to do this that you find productive?
I think that there are, at least at the current time, sociological reasons that drive those caucus issues, if you will. But your hope is over time, in large measure, that that goes away. And that, again, people are judged based on the quality of ideas and the quality of the work they perform.
Well, as we know, there is a glass ceiling, and we know that women are generally paid less. Not as much so as it used to be, but still less than men get paid. I was very interested in your espousal of a minimum wage hike. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, the place where I come out on the minimum wage hike is it clearly is necessary, but at the same time, we have to be very careful about small businesses, which is where the president went in his State of the Union message, that we need to provide tax credits to small businesses so that you get that balance. All of that being said, if you look at what the minimum wage hike would do, it still, in most cases, does not bring people above the poverty level. So there has to be a wider array, if you will, of supports in place to accomplish that. And my belief is, from just a very pragmatic standpoint, that since 70% of the United States economy is consumer-driven, and people who are earning the least spend all of the dollars that they earn, every dollar you give to them is dollars that goes into consumption, which drives our economy. So this is a, I used to refer to this as the trickle-up theory. Reagan had the trickle-down theory. I think this is a trickle-up theory. The more money you give to the folks at the bottom, the more they're going to spend, the more you're going to drive the economy. And I think that that could have a beneficial across-the-board impact.
Congressman Bill Owens represents New York's 21st congressional district. He's announced his intention to retire at the end of the year. March is Women's History Month, and while our Women in History commentator Gilles Malkin is hard at work on the next edition of his profiles, I wanted to revisit one of my favorites. Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us is in the drawer of my bedside table, a book I'm going through slowly, savoring, and learning from with every chapter. She's the woman credited with waking us up to our impact on the environment. Here's Gilles Malkin.
Although many people become heroes in ways that touch many of us, few become champions of a cause that concerns us all. Although you may never have heard of her, Rachel Carson was such a person. She espoused the cause of our environment in such a basic, understandable, and beautiful way that no violator will ever again be let off the hook for ignorance on the subject. Carson was born in 1907 and raised in rural Pennsylvania, was drawn to poetry, and early in her youth was gifted of the love of nature by her mother. Fascinated by marine biology, she earned her master's from Johns Hopkins in 1932. She began by working as a writer for the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries and wrote articles on the subject of natural history for the Baltimore Sun. She then worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and eventually became their chief editor. However, she opted to follow her penchant for personal writing and published a book called The Sea Around Us that brought her international acclaim and admiration, revealing her ability to articulate a personal love for nature so purely that it caused everyone who read it to aspire to her level of appreciation of the wonders of nature. She had an ability to render scientific facts and observations into passionate and irresistible prose, and her book was a bestseller for over a year and a half. "Once or twice in a generation," wrote the New York Times book critic, "does the world get a physical scientist with literary genius? Miss Carson has written a classic." She became concerned about the agricultural employment of poisons and devoted herself to the task of warning us about their use, which brings us to her 1962 magnum opus, Silent Spring. This book, which endures as a living testament to her own undying respect and love for our planet, first appeared as a series of articles in The New Yorker and was published in its entirety by Houghton Mifflin the same year. The White House, Congress, and scientists all hailed the work and gave it the highest praise and attention. The resistance from the industry was loud and nasty, and others who were not learned in the subject also objected to having to discontinue new and effective methods of controlling pests. The public were unaware that DDT and other like substances had been produced as military weapons for use in World War II, the ample stockpiles of which were now adapted to pesticide use for disposal. She explained that those substances do not stay where they're put and don't fade away once the task they've been given has been carried out. They can contaminate the countryside, poisoning animals and humans, as she discovered in long and painstaking research on a book she had not even planned to write. Silent Spring advocated for banning certain pesticides and restricting and regulating the use and volume of other questionable chemicals whose toxicity and destructive effects were apparent, and for the start of a new biotic approach to the control of harmful pests. She pointed to chemical industry propaganda and lamented the lack of questioning from those responsible for public health and safety. The expansion of environmental awareness began to snowball, and by 1969, the president was forwarded a congressional bill called the National Environment Policy Act, or NEPA. In 1970, the Environmental Protection Agency became a living entity, and the war against pollution was launched. The story of its birth in itself is worth looking up and reading about because it's so rare that such a concerted and concentrated effort was made and achieved, and don't think it's easy for Congress to do that. Quote, in fact, the EPA today may be said, without exaggeration, to be the extended shadow of Rachel Carson, unquote, wrote Jack Lewis in a 1985 edition of the EPA Journal. Since then, thousands of dedicated people have joined the fight, and many battles have been lost and won, but the consciousness against pollutants is stronger than ever today. And today, as even ordinary people continue to develop ideas and find practical solutions to progress without pollution, new ways of working with nature instead of against her are within our grasp. We have but to implement them. But Rachel Carson's story went much deeper. While she was writing the book in 1960, she underwent a radical mastectomy for breast cancer. She kept that story private, not wishing, as she said, to give the chemical producers any pleasure. But it was not cured, and she died of it in 1964 at the age of 56. In her final speech, Rachel Carson said, underlying all of these problems of introducing contamination into our world is the question of moral responsibility. The threat is infinitely greater to the generations unborn, to those who have no voice in the decisions of today, and that fact alone makes our responsibility a heavy one. It's become evident since her passing that she knew whereof she spoke. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.